Welcome. I'm Sam Ben-Ruby for Heritage Radio Network. on tour. We're broadcasting live from the Le Creuset podcast studio at Charleston Wine and Food. Today we're celebrating International Women's Day, and our lineup is full of women and food and drink that inspire us. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/Charleston2019 to see our full interview schedule. We want to thank Le Creuset and the Julia Child Foundation for making Heritage Radio on tour at Charleston Wine and Food possible. Welcome to the Grape Nation part of our on tour radio broadcast. Today, we are down at the Charleston Wine and Food Festival, and I have a panel of three terrific people to celebrate International Women's Day. First, let me introduce our panel, and then we'll get into each of them a little, what they're doing, and then we're going to get into some stuff pretty deep. Morgan Calcote is the reigning James Beard Award-winning winner for Outstanding Wine Program in the country. She is the General Manager and Wine Director at FIG right here in Charleston. Jillian Charette is Associate Editor and Director of Restaurant Awards at Wine Spectator magazine. She also has a tasting beat of France and Portugal and is a tasting coordinator at the magazine, still, right? And Laura Brennan Bissell went from an aspiring tattoo artist to the proprietor of her one-woman project, Incanu and La Lalu, making low-intervention wines from organically farmed grapes. Her wines are inspired by the French tradition of vin de... Vin du soif. My French stinks, so I'm glad you're here, which translates into wine of thirst. All right, welcome to the show, everybody. Thank you for taking time out of all your busy schedules. I know you're all running around. Today is International Women's Day, so I really want to talk about women and wine, if you guys don't mind. I think the first thing is, tell me if you think women have made strides in the past years in the wine world, you know, and how it affects you. I mean, Jillian, you're on the publishing side. Is it something you notice or not necessarily?
Absolutely. Yeah, our editorial coverage is including women more and more, whether they're chefs, restaurateurs. Oh, yeah, definitely. Right. And just looking at our restaurant awards program, I look at many a wine list every year and the people that are involved in them. And more you come across women in various capacity. And definitely in the regions I cover, in Provence, Languedoc-Roussillon, Portugal, I'm finding more and more women becoming more heavily involved in the wine world. So it's very exciting.
Right. Now, not to be negative, but is there any negative where you see things are not happening?
Not necessarily. I mean, obviously...
So it's going in the right direction.
It's going in the right direction. Okay. Obviously, this change like that doesn't happen overnight. But
right.
I think it's more the long game here.
But change is on the way. Mm-hmm. And Morgan, you're more on the ground. You know, you're literally on the floor of a restaurant. And that's a totally different environment. I know in New York, and in your case, I mean, women are really starting to, you know, have prominence in the business. Do you feel women are still being underserved in the business, or that's changing?
Again, I think to second what you just said is we're heading in the right direction. You
okay.
know, I think that, you know, in the 6 years I've been at FIG, I've seen a shift in a lot of aspects of restaurant culture, locally and nationally, all for the better. We're starting conversations that need to be had, being more conscientious and mindful about the decisions we're making, the practices that we value in restaurants. And a lot of that, I think, concerns, you know, equality across a range of parameters. And I'm really loving the diversity and the energy and the kind of like positive momentum that we're building as a restaurant community to recognize people with talent.
Right.
You know, regardless of you know, what their demographic is.
Right.
Yeah.
Laura, I mean, the nice thing is here we're getting three different perspectives. Laura is a winemaker, and I guess I throw that question to you. You know, you are a woman winemaker.
Mm-hmm.
I think, and I'm saying that kindly, it's a male-dominated business. tell me, you know, your feelings.
I as well see a lot of progression with women coming into the industry, in particular over the past couple years. I feel like a lot more like younger women coming up have been reaching out, you know, saying, I want to be a winemaker, I want to work in wine, I want to be a viticulturist, how do I go about doing it?
They're not scared away, they're looking to take
Yeah, exactly. Like, I feel like there's more of an emphasis of inclusivity, which is awesome.
But are they being accepted and pointed in the right direction now more than ever, you think?
I think so. I mean, and I think that that's partly because there's been a bit of a spotlight put on women who have made it work.
Right.
So you have, like, it's not just Kathy Corson, you know.
Right. The old school.
Yeah.
Like, who trailblazers.
Is amazing.
Yeah.
But you have more people to reach out to kind of find your guiding light.
Right.
And I think that that's the case for viticulture as well. There's, you know, one of the most powerful tools I've come across is a message board called Vit Women, which...
Spell it?
Vit Women. It's like V-I-T Women.
Okay.
And Debbie Zigglebaum, who unfortunately passed away this past year, she was a longtime, very important viticulturist in Napa. Had started it, and
the site is still up though.
Yep, and the message board still carries on in her honor, and that's been incredible for networking for women.
Great. Yes or no question, and if you have to add to it, you can. Are women somms, women winemakers, women in journalism, are they perceived and treated the same as men? You go first, Jillian.
All right. Well, in journalism, that's a complicated answer, of course. I mean, I can speak at Wine Spectator. Women are definitely held to the same exact standard. So that doesn't necessarily matter. So, yeah.
Morgan, I know the old story is a person would go into a restaurant, a female somm would come up, and they'd say, where's the sommelier? You know, I mean, I think we're a little beyond that. But are women perceived and treated the same as men?
I think yes and no with increasing yeses.
Okay. All right. Laura?
I still will tell people that I'm a winemaker, and they'll ask me if I do it in my garage or, like, if I'm the accountant because my husband...
Like, you're not serious about doing
this for a
living.
Yeah, no, I'm not seriously
right.
a winemaker. Or, oh, so you, like, do the marketing and your husband's
right.
a winemaker. You know what I'm
so,
like, no.
Jillian, you kind of hit it. It's a complicated answer.
Mm-hmm.
I think strides are being made. I think you expressed that, and we all agree. And I still think there's... you know, some ways to go, which is good. And I think guys like you, women like you, you know, can help trailblaze that. If someone came to you, you and you, and I just pointed to our three guests, and wanted to get in the business quickly, what advice would you give them? Because you're the gatekeepers and the encouragers and the influencers. Jillian, what would you...
Well, in terms of my background, how I got to Wine Spectator, it was a career change. I did go to school for hospitality, but then I was in the world of real estate. Wine was kind of hovering in the background a little bit. My dad was in hospitality. He had a couple restaurants, actually one that was in the Wine Spectator Restaurant Awards program. I didn't learn that until a few years.
Right.
My dad neglected to tell
so
me that.
So you've had some exposure
yeah,
to all that world.
But when I decided to make the change into wine, it's a hustle. I mean, there's a lot to learn. You kind of have to show your passion.
But we're talking from you being a woman aspect.
Oh, okay.
Hustle more? Not necessarily?
You know, I mean... I'm in New York, and so I think that's a little bit of a bubble, but I think it's pretty equal in that regard. It's just that you have to definitely go well beyond,
right.
You know, you have to go above and beyond with everything,
right.
And I think you kind of have to prove yourself to everyone, and then once you're able to do that, then...
I agree.
Yeah.
Morgan, I'm in love with wine. You know, I'd like to work at a restaurant, wine service. I bump into you, family, friend, or whatever. You know, I'm a young woman. What would you tell me?
I would ask you how serious you are about restaurants in general, because it
so
takes,
commitment is a huge deal.
Yeah, yeah. I think that that a certain level, the pursuit of wine knowledge and being a wine, you know, focused career and professional, it takes a lot of. Love. You don't do it because it's easy. You don't do it because you can hit a barrier or a baseline and be like, okay, I'm good. Like, because wine's changing all the time. You're always having
right,
to
that
get
applies
the books
to anything, but
right,
wine
yeah.
is so vast and complicated. You got to
right.
get like
so,
all
like, that's,
in.
That's question one for anybody.
Right.
And then, you know, the next part of it is find a culture, find a restaurant that has a culture of bringing people up, of teaching staff that's eager to learn, that makes a knowledge and access to tastings and to winemakers and to experiences that will broaden and deepen your knowledge. Part of what they offer, in addition to, you know, maybe the odd somm shift on the floor or helping, you know, stock bottles, whatever it is, and just take the opportunities that come, ask questions. Don't be afraid to admit that you don't know, because I get asked questions all the time, and I'm like, I don't know. Let me check.
You don't know what you don't know, right?
Right. I can find out, and then we'll both know. Right. And I think that's it. Just having, putting yourself outside of your comfort zone in terms of admitting vulnerability, with you know, the need to learn and the desire to have access to something. I think that's a lot of challenge in maybe not particular to women, but something I found challenging was asking for what I wanted, asking for what
right.
I
That's
needed
a great point.
To progress.
Great point. Laura, I mean, more and more women are getting into winemaking. Still not a lot. Just as I asked Morgan, somebody comes up to you and says, I'd really love to make wine. You want to encourage any person interested, and we want more women, but what would you tell this person?
I'm a big fan of the Ruth Bader Ginsburg approach,
which is
work harder and smarter. Don't get angry. Keep trying. If somebody slams the door in your face, go to the next door, knock again. You'll find your people. You know, I think that in a certain way, people viewing us as weaker as women is like a superpower. It gives you this kind of quiet entrance of making a whole bunch of stuff happen and then boom, surprise, like you have gotten to your place. And
that's a great answer. All right, let's talk a little about wine, all right? And thank you for that, Laura. Let's talk about wine lists. I want to talk about natural wines a little, and I want you to give me a take on exciting new wines, regions, and grapes. So let's talk wine lists first. Morgan and Gillian, we know wine lists could be intimidating. Gillian, I mean, you have a lot of experience in this. Morgan, you're one of the people that takes a large amount of wine available and figures out how to make a smaller list great. What's the best advice you give to a customer, you know, or a friend when they say, God, you know, I walk into a restaurant and the wine list, I don't want to look stupid in front of my friends, or I don't know what to do. You know, what are the 2-3 things? Morgan, you start.
Sure. You know, I think, again, it's like asking for help. That's where it's got to
start. It's on the person to ask, though. But if they don't, it's on you to pull it out.
Right. Well, yeah. I think it's a two-way street there. Like, the guest should, you know, hopefully be getting more comfortable with the idea that we're there to help guide them with selections that we made with you know, the concept of the restaurant and the menu in mind. But then also the capable and aware staff should also be meeting them in the middle. And if they're flipping through pages and saying all these words and not really kind of like have an aura of confidence, then we should be able to, are there, you know, can we help narrow some things down for you? Can we have a conversation? Do you want to discuss? What are you looking for? So that getting the conversation started is huge.
Kind of. The attitude goes out the door a little, because I think that's what people get intimidated by.
Sure, yeah, and I think that, you know, I think that kind of like haughty and removed sommelier is maybe a stereotype of the past. I think there's enough young people, enough on both sides, dining and serving, that are excited about wine, and that the ego is kind of deflating in that realm of restaurants, which I love, because it shouldn't be intimidating. Wine is. It's alcohol. It's there to help facilitate a good time and add flavor to a table, you know, and there's nothing about that should be like, well, are you good enough to have this wine?
Right.
Or do you know enough to be able to, you know, so I think that generally is falling away. So I think that there is less barrier to kind of getting the right bottle on the table in restaurant scenarios.
Gillian, what's your take? I mean, how do you get somebody to ultimately get to the best selections?
Yeah, you know, when I go out to restaurants, especially the ones that are really wine-centric, I know that are passionate about wine, I love to be surprised. I love to be like, hey, here's my price point. Show me something that you're excited about, you know?
But that's good advice that you're not dwelling on. You mm-hmm. have to lay out there, here's right. what I want to spend.
Right. Yeah. And I have no...
And what other things? I like red. I like white. Yeah. You know, I like French. You got to lay it all on the table,
I lay it
right?
all on the table and I say, you know, show me what you're excited about. Because, I mean, these wine directors, these sommeliers, they put a lot of time, passion into these programs. So show me what you're excited about. I think it ends up, you get a lot of discovery out of that and maybe pleasant surprise or, you know, because that's what wine is. It's discovery a lot of the time.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Do we still agree that there's like some snooty wine people out there with attitude and that's why I'm even asking the question?
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, okay. There's snooty people for anything. So. All right. It's going to exist.
All right, Laura, I want to turn this to you in a different way. So you have someone who writes about wines, wine lists, you know, runs an awards program. Morgan, who really takes time and pains to make the right selections. What does someone like you tell these guys to get on a list? You know, I mean, you have a story, but there's so much shelf space.
So, honestly, I actually don't want my story to speak for my wine. I like my wine to just stand alone and be what it is. I have a kind of internal churning about wine being so story-based at this point, because wine is a consumer good that has to do with flavor and taste and smell. And yes, stories can be cool, but the bottom line for me is that a wine is pleasurable. So if I was tasting with Morgan, for example, or Jillian, I wouldn't really want them to know my story. I would want them to taste the wine. And then we
wine
talk
first
about,
before the story?
Yeah, absolutely.
This sucks, get out of here. This is great. What's your story?
If that's how somebody feels, that's fine.
Okay.
I mean, it's subjective.
Okay.
But yeah,
that's an interesting take. I didn't want to talk about this, but I'll bring it up for a second. Millennials, which are kind of taking over, you know, the market, are becoming customers and influencers. How are they affecting the wine market? Are they buying? Because the reason I ask the question is, I think millennials are about stories. They're interested in a wine that has a story. But are they spending as much? Are they spending as much on wine? Are they spending as much time in a restaurant? What's your take on that?
Our readership, I mean, we definitely do have millennials who are readers, but our readership is not really
that
generation.
That's not the wheelhouse core audience.
That's not the wheelhouse. I mean, but maybe down the road they will become, you know, a
right.
Wine Spectator reader. But I know that, you know, from the Restaurant Awards perspective, we're having younger and younger people who are directors of, you know, of these wine programs. And so they're doing some really interesting things, you know, kind of really curating wine lists to their clientele, but also kind of pushing the envelope
right.
beyond that. So I think in that regard, you know, they're kind of into that discovery a little bit more. They tend to go a little bit more freely off the beaten path. And, you know, they're not going to just stick to the tried and true for the most part. So that's exciting.
What about you, Morgan, on the floor? Is that becoming a bigger, more important customer, or you still have your base?
Yeah, I think it's shifting a little bit, you know.
Not a lot.
You know, I think that some of that's maybe particular to Fig, you know, and in particular to, and we're a small restaurant with a relatively small wine list, but I think the way restaurants are moving forward, the wine lists are smaller, the restaurants are smaller, the atmosphere may be even a little more relaxed and less kind of fine dining. And I think that's where probably younger generations are gravitating more towards for affordability reasons,
right.
Which is understandable because while there are more people in that generation that are buying wine, relative bottle price, I would say, is lower than other demographics that are maybe a little more financially secure
right.
in different parts in their life. So, but we do see it, you know. It's,
yeah. So it's not a major
yeah.
factor yet.
Yeah, I think it's growing.
It's shifting.
Yeah, and I think
yeah.
you see that they're probably more like on the retail side of things and more casual restaurants. And I think I see a lot more kind of casual, smaller restaurants that have really like thoughtful, like 30 bottle lists that are a lot of fun and have great wines for their food and are, you know, like the average bottle price is lower than maybe something we hit.
I would like to sit down with you in 5 years and see how the answer changes.
Yeah.
Now, you've been making wine for a few years. Who are you trying to appeal to? Is it necessarily millennials? It's everybody? Is it naturally? I mean, the question isn't, are you marketing to millennials? But who is the consumer right now, the audience?
So in 7 years of being a producer, I've gotten to see some shift in this. I think that there's like a difference between Instagrammable wines and what people are actually drinking. You may not see La Pierre Morgon on Instagram every day, but people are drinking a lot of it.
I see a lot of Beaujolais.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Kind of hot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
yeah, you're right.
But the basics, you know, they're still being consumed. I think that price point is something to consider. You know, the 60-year-old primarily male market buying $100 cabs, that's, you know, decreasing. So price, yes, definitely a factor. But I do think that we'll hear something about millennial fatigue eventually, where people get tired of drinking a different bottle of wine every night, you know,
right,
wanting to try every new thing,
point,
having a great experience. And, you know, we're humans. We like patterns.
Right.
So I think that will die back a bit.
I want to get your take, and I don't want to spend a ton of time on it, on natural wines. There's sort of a movement. Jillian, you know, Wine Spectator, you talked about their audience, and I think their wheelhouse is, you know, Bordeaux, Burgundy, you know, all the great regions there, and beyond. Tell me your take on natural wines, the natural wine movement. I'm just curious.
I mean, it's definitely interesting, and but when it comes to our reviewing of wines, just a brief overview, each taster is assigned certain regions, what we call beats, and then they become the expert of that region. They are in charge of kind of understanding the benchmark, understanding the grape varieties, the styles that are a part of that region. And the way that we taste is blind, so we don't know the producer, we don't know the price. And, you know, natural wines are held against the same standards as regular wines. So some are great, some are not so great, just like every other wine out there.
Are you tasting them at Wine Spectator? Does somebody...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. So absolutely. Our basic requirements are that wines be imported into the United States, because that's where our audience is. But they are bagged up and camouflaged just like any other wine. So
So they're subject to the same
To the same criteria.
Which is, that's one of the benefits of blind tasting in that sense. Now, Morgan, you're a purveyor of natural wines, not exclusively. What's your take?
You know, I think that the term natural wine, it continues to get muddied.
That's the other thing, too. I like real wine, but people don't.
Yeah, I think it's the way that, like, in the culinary world, like, the word, like, the phrase farm to table, it's like, well, yeah, sure, it's a produce. It came from a farm of some scale. In the same way people are like, natural wines, yeah, okay, sure, it came from grapes, but, like, I understand there's a lot of room in between, you know, the grape vine being planted and it ultimately becoming a wine, and there's lots of decisions and intentions that can get set there. And you know, we don't have a hard line at the restaurant, basically. I don't have a hard line about, like, yes, it must be natural, or no, you know, no conventional wines or whatever. I think that there's so much gray in the middle, and the really, and again, to second what you said, is that the wine should be held to the same standard. You know, it can have a great story. It can be no sulfur and, you know, foot trod and what have you. But if it's not good, then I can't sell it. I don't want to drink it.
Held to that standard. Laura, you are a real winemaker. You are a low intervention person. Give me your take on it.
So,
and I think one of the problems, and I didn't mean to interrupt, is just asking a question where there's a kind of a moniker, you know, tell me about natural wine.
I'm so comfortable talking about this at this point.
Okay.
I think that the term natural wine is basically a greenwashing term at this point. I think that it just doesn't really mean anything, and I think that unfortunately it's used as a like an excuse for bad wine.
So
not across the board.
So I totally get that. Yeah. So how do we refer to it?
So I would refer to myself as a low intervention maker or winemaker, that I make real wine. I think that there are plenty of people who use the moniker natural wine who also make beautiful, amazing wine, But I think that there's also like a placation of a lot of bad winemaking or people who lie about their vineyards and then use the term natural wine to hide behind.
Right.
So I just don't trust it anymore. I used to trust it.
I think when things were happening, you know, the references were there. Now it's become very specific. I mean, what you do is low intervention. You're making real wine.
Mm-hmm.
Just saying you're a natural winemaker is almost...
I mean, saying I'm a natural winemaker scares me because I think that then somebody's going to think that my wines are going to be extremely volatile or mousy. Because that's what a lot of people think when they hear that term.
Right.
And I strive to make good wine. That's what I want to do. Yeah. So.
All right, so I want to ask you guys what people should be drinking now. And Jillian, you have a specific beat at Wine Spectator.
Mm-hmm.
You cover Portugal.
Yes.
Which is a very interesting wine area.
Mm-hmm.
And you cover parts of France.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me some good grapes, regions.
Right.
And let's back you to the wall a little more and see if we could come up with women winemakers.
Sure, absolutely.
Doesn't have to be, but where you could think of it.
Absolutely. So I cover the table wines of Portugal. My colleague, senior editor James Molesworth, covers the fortified wines. So,
right.
Port. but Portugal is super exciting. It's very dynamic. I mean, obviously, the Douro Valley is where a lot of people have been going towards for their amazing red wines and white wines. Sandra Tavares da Silva, she is the winemaker for Wine and Soul. She works with her husband, George, too. But she's super cool. Wine and Soul is producing some amazing reds and white wines. And she used to work for Christian von Zeller after she graduated enology school. But she splits her time between Wine and Soul and Quinto de Chacapala, which is her family's winery in the Lisboa region. And that's a really cool dynamic region in Portugal if we're looking outside of the Douro Valley,
right.
That she's working on, which is different from the Douro. It's southern. It's farther south. It's just it's on the coast, so you get some coastal influence. Other really cool areas are Filipa Pato. She is at the Barada region. And I haven't officially reviewed her wines, but I have had them. But she is just a force when it comes to, because she calls it wine without makeup. So,
nice.
But she's kind of discovering the indigenous grape varieties out of the Barada region. White and red, and she does a lot of experimenting with amphora and all that cool stuff.
Very cool.
Yeah, so just...
What about France?
So in France...
Tell me the areas that you cover.
I cover Beaujolais. I also Languedoc, Roussillon, southwest France, and most recently Provence, starting this year.
So is Beaujolais hotter than ever right now?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's becoming more expensive than ever, too.
True.
But, no, I love Beaujolais. When I was in the Languedoc last time I was there, I met with Marie Chaffray, who is the winemaker for Domaine de la Réserve de Eau, which is a cool region in the Thérèse de la Zarque region. And she's a force too. Her and her husband had a wine shop in Paris, and they decided they want to make wine, so they went to the south of France. It's her and her husband. They do biodynamic, they do low intervention, but she actually became president of the syndicate of Thérèse de la Zarque and was the one who helped make it become a cru in the Languedoc in 2014.
Cool.
So she's really cool too.
Very cool. Morgan, obviously some wines are exciting you now. You're always adding things and tasting things. I mean, I'm anxious to hear from you. You know, what's exciting out there, whether it's a region, a varietal, a maker, you know, give me a few.
Sure. I think that, you know, the focus of the wine list is you know, seasonally driven. So, and
right.
menu driven. So it's always in flux and I'm always.
Those are two major things at a restaurant.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, we're always looking to like find these exciting wines. That
well,
are
I'm
delicious.
Asking you what.
So I find that I find myself gravitating, a couple of places. I think the Loire, for all of its kind of you know, storied histories, like, to me, I mean, Huet, yeah. Like that. There's so stalwart to the
true
region.
True vignerons.
But it's so diverse, and it's so large, and there's a relative accessibility there, and there's a younger generation that is taking a look at, you know, maybe some vines that are not being paid attention to or have not been used, and utilizing these amazing sites to make some really energetic wines. And I find that those are
does that naturally, when you say Loire, does it naturally point to a lot of Chenin?
Personal preference, yeah. But I do a lot of Chenin.
Right, no. So Loire, Chenin, what else? Give me another.
I think the Cabernet Franc, Gamay, and looking to the Western Loire and things like, you know, Chardonnay, Muscadet, Pinot Noir even out there, all have this wonderful energy and minerality and this kind of like juicy acidity very often that is so so food appropriate, also very climatically appropriate for a relatively warm city that we're in. So that I find really exciting. You know, I think there are areas in southern France that are really, again, have that same kind of access to relatively affordable vineyards where people can
right.
get their hands dirty and start making wine. And I always love champagne. I feel like it's three French answers,
yeah.
But that's not my
right.
overall preference. But
so you're putting more and more yeah. champagne on the list.
I always try to have like a little too much on the list, you know.
That's good. That's happening at a lot of places, which
yeah.
is good. Now, Laura, what do you just don't drink your own wines. I know that.
Yeah.
What are you liking now? What are you trying?
I actually very seldom drink my own wine.
Figured that.
I try not to. I joke that I like to drink Grower Champagne, Longhay Nebbiolo, and Cabernet Riesling. That's really
Jesus,
what
that's like a sommelier's dream, right? Riesling, champagne.
Yeah.
And yeah. not Sangiovese, but, you know,
yeah,
Nebbiolo
yeah,
and
yeah.
all that.
Yeah. I just did a tasting at a friend of mine's house the other night of Alto Piemontese wines. So
very
that was
interesting
amazing.
Wines.
We did 8 of the 9 appellations there.
Morgan, those are reasonably priced wines, right?
Yes, yeah, and exciting. And said, like, the higher altitude Nebbiolo, that the expression there is so... so good, and so much more accessible
yeah.
than things, you know, like Barolo Barbaresco, especially in their youth and price wise too, really.
Yeah.
And there's some whites there that are really intriguing. Yeah, Northern Italy in general has got some really nice pockets of.
All right, we're gonna wrap up in a few minutes, but I had one more question. It's more of a curiosity, and Morgan, you'll go last on this. But I'm just amazed how the restaurant and wine scene in Charleston has blown up. I mean, you're down here, you know, doing that. Jillian, you're down here. I mean, more than other cities. Why is that happening? Why do you think that a Charleston just continues to expand and blow up?
Well, I think it's a beautiful city to begin with. Hospitality is a key here. And you want to know what, like with the big cities, New York, San Francisco, LA, it's expensive and hard to do business there. And so there's so much talent
Good
that they're
point.
Kind of spilling out into the second tier, third tier cities, as are people who need to just live in general and who appreciate, like, you know, like restaurants and things like that. So I think that's what's happening, part of it. And, you know, Charleston is just super charming. And,
yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
Laura, I mean, a lot of cities are showing growth. That, but Charleston just continues to really blow up. I mean, as an observer, what do you think?
I really like gin and oysters.
Okay. So where else are you going to go, right?
Place to be.
Gin and oysters.
The food scene.
We could answer that question. Here's the question. Why has the Charleston food scene blown up, you know, in such a big way? Her answer is 3 words. Gin and oysters.
That's so succinct,
that.
Yeah.
We're going to leave it at that. Listen, you experienced this. What, you know,
yeah.
Why is this... continue, and is it getting too hot or too big?
That's a loaded question. That part of the question. I think that Charleston, you know, I've lived here most of my life, and you know, I've always been enamored of the natural environs and the historic nature of the city, and I think that secret is long since out. The relative affordability, I think, is a huge function for investors, for talent, for people who are ready to leave a more kind of rat race paced city and find a little more, you know, balance between work and life on the industry side of things. And we are challenged, you know, we rents are increasing here. It's labor market is relatively shallow, or, you know, labor pool is relatively shallow with high demand for employees. You know, transportation and all those things that come with a burgeoning city are really starting to put pressures on the city to make smart moves for continued growth and success, and fostering all these kind of new ventures. And tourism is such a big driver for us that you know, really injects a lot of interest, even if it's not permanent residency.
So even with a college in town and a reputation for hospitality, it's still hard to get good people because it's a huge pool.
It is, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of people that want to hire. There's restaurants opening all the time, or cafes, or, you know, shops, or breweries, and there's so much opportunity for people here that that the available, you know, labor pool gets spread really thin across a lot of really good options.
Right.
So that's, you know, it's something that not exclusive to the food and beverage here. I know that affects other industries as well, but we feel the burn on all levels.
Yeah. We're going to wrap up, guys. I want to thank everybody for coming in. Today is International Women's Day, so thank you for sharing your thoughts on everything. I want to thank Le Creuset and the Julia Child Foundation for making Heritage Radio Network on tour at Charleston Wine and Food possible. I want to thank Morgan Calcote from Fig in Charleston, Jillian Chiaretta, Associate Editor of Wine Spectator, and Lauren Brennan Bissell from Incanu, and Lalalu Wines. Where could we find the wines? If people want to know more about the wines,
I mean,
and then attempt to get them, what's the best way to dive into that?
IncanuWine.com is a good place to
start. Okay, I-N-C-O-N-N-U.
Wine.
Okay, and can you order wine on the site?
Yep, most states we can ship to. But I mean, I encourage people to go to their local wine shop and ask for it.
And if they don't have it, tell them to get it.
Exactly.
Because Laura sent you.
Uh-huh.
All right. And Jillian, what's coming out on the next issue or stand or coming out?
The next one that's going to be coming out will be on Italy and discoveries in Italy.
Okay.
So a little bit all over the place. So really excited about that.
Okay, look for that. And Morgan, they just announced the James Beard semifinalists for wine programs. So you're at the end of your tenure basking in your glory.
Yes, yeah.
Things are still going well at the restaurant, right?
Things are wonderful, and we were very pleasantly surprised to be a semifinalist for Outstanding Restaurant for the foundation this year. So,
right.
So, you know, we just keep getting all this really amazing and humbling complimentary attention. So we're just enjoying it and trying to make sure people have a great time when they come to see us.
You definitely have it going, and you're doing a bunch of stuff for the Charleston Wine and Food Festival, too. So look out for that. All right, I'm Sam Ben-Ruby from the Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. Heritage Radio Network is a member-supported nonprofit based in Bushwick, Brooklyn. If any of you guys are ever in Bushwick, please come by and visit us. I'll buy you a pizza. Listen to over 10,000 episodes of Food Radio podcasts and become a member at heritageradionetwork.org. And thank you for listening, and stay tuned for programming all day.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Heritage_Radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.